Okay.
Oh, it works. All right, good. Questions? A couple of you are taking the eco exam after class. We'll do that here. If you have not and need to take it, if you have not taken Form B yet, we need to schedule that this week and get that out of the way. And for those of you who still have to retake it, Form C will be ready on Monday, and we will have a session after class on Monday here. So if you can work that into your schedule, do so, and if you can't, then check with Julie or me and schedule another time. Okay? We do have exercise 4 to give back at the end of class today. Yes, Julie has the record with her. Other housekeeping things? Now that we have 4 done, we'll start working on 5. Of you wrote exercise 4.
I
It doesn't translate into a grade until the end of the course. You're accumulating points. And I will this week put up the distribution of points at this point, so you have some sense of whether or not you need to be worrying a little bit or a moderate amount or a whole bunch. And anybody who needs to be worrying a whole bunch, remember that Julie has office hours on Monday from 11 to 1. Greg is available for a consultation. I'm available. If the stuff isn't making sense to you yet, or you're having difficulty writing in a way that lets us know that it's making sense to you, please come see us. We are interested in everybody understanding it first and then getting a reasonable grade second, and we will do everything we can to help you do that. So don't go it alone if it's not making sense to you yet. I don't know. The question was, how many people will get A's or B's or C's? I don't have a quota. It'll depend in part on what that distribution looks like, how spread out it is. Partly it depends on whether or not I can convince myself that there is a qualitative difference between one set of scores and another set. So one is B and one is C. I'm not interested, and nobody requires me to give only 10% A's and at least 10% F's. So that's not part of it. There are schools and departments that do that, that require a specific shape to the distribution. We don't do that, and I wouldn't teach someplace that required me to do that. So I'm not in the game of making any of you miserable or making you retake the course. But if you clearly don't understand it and haven't done the work, then you're not going to do well. But I'm sorry, I have to be vague on that just simply because I don't know. Pardon? Okay. Anything else? Excuse me, I need to. Yes. I managed to push the wrong button on Wednesday and didn't record the lecture, so if you were looking for it, it's first time. Hopefully the last time. Now I just have to, when I stop it, I have to also save it. Little thing like that. Technology, yeah, love it. Okay, we're okay. We were talking on Wednesday last week about something that you had questions about, maybe. That was the next question. Breaking up is hard to do. Remember that song? Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about breaking up, and I had, I think, made the bold statement that, well, I was about to make the bold statement that when people break up, they do all kinds of stupid things, and I know I had mentioned stalking. The basic issue is, in breaking up, the basic issue is taking your mesosystems apart again after having put them together. The longer you have created a shared mesosystem, the more difficult it is, typically, to separate your mesosystems. It's easier if you haven't lived together and haven't been together very long and don't own anything together and don't have children. It just makes the task easier to accomplish. The longer you have been together, the longer you have shared a microsystem, the more joint entanglements you have, such as property or children, the more difficulty you have in taking that mesosystem apart and separating it. The essential process, and I think this is where I stopped on Wednesday, the essential process, personally and developmentally, is to get out of the relationship, do the emotional healing, and make sense, to interpret what has happened. And I recall on Wednesday talking a bit about having a different script is okay. The two people do not have to agree on their interpretation of what the relationship was like or what went wrong or whose fault it was. They each get to interpret that. And what you're working toward developmentally is to take that ecological transition, the change in role, and possibly the change in setting, and interpret it in a way that gives you a valid view of yourself and the relationship, and time to figure out what you've learned and how you want to go into a next relationship, should there ever be one, how you want to go into that relationship in a way that takes you, the best possible version of you, into it. The reading that you have by Morano on if you're divorced, don't even think about getting remarried until you read this, describes some of the process of putting together a new interpretation of yourself and creating a sense of identity that is separate from your prior role of being somebody's partner. That process of creating a new identity and accepting the new role of being yourself now, and then after you've enjoyed that, available for another role, that process sometimes takes a good deal of time. And it is important time, as Morano is suggesting in her article. We have some interesting new data on the importance of that time from a study that's been going on for several years now at the University of Minnesota. An old friend of mine has been studying dating in adolescence, and he's picked up subjects for his study to interview and give psychological tests and assessments to. He's picked them up at the beginning of adolescence, and he's studying them longitudinally. And it turns out that nobody has ever done this kind of study before. So it's becoming quite fascinating. We have a lot of information about dating, but we don't really have very good studies of what people are constructing as they go through the dating process. So Andy Collins is looking at that process. And as people start to date in adolescence, he's trying to recruit their partners into the study so he can talk to both of them. And then when they separate, as typically happens in adolescence, then he's trying to continue with both of them and their new partners when they start to date. So it's a study that he says it kind of grows like a mushroom, and he has this interlocking... actually, it'd be interesting to do a mesosystem analysis of the ecosystems of the subjects in his studies who are from all over the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And some of them now are well into college. In fact, this year I think the first subjects would be 22 or so. So they might, some of them might be graduating. Not all of them have gone to college. He's trying to keep a fairly diverse group going. What he's documented is what kinds of skills people learn or don't learn in their relationships, what the satisfactions and dissatisfactions are in the relationships, the diversity of relationships that people form, how quickly they become serious, how slowly they become serious in other cases, how quickly they fall apart, how slowly they fall apart. And he's got a huge amount of data on these relationships. But the part I want to focus on is breaking up and what happens between relationships for adolescents and now in his study young adults in college or college age. And the fascinating thing that he had difficulty understanding when he first started seeing it in the pattern as he was analyzing data. We spent a fun afternoon, several of us, looking at his data and figuring out, and some of you have heard this before, but figuring out what was going on. And more recently, he's talked about confirming some of the hypotheses that we came up with that day. And he's preparing a publication on what happens, what people learn in relationships, and what people learn between relationships. And it turns out that what people learn between relationships as they're making sense out of the relationship that they've gotten out of, that is as important for developing relationship skills as what they do in relationship. Okay, let me say that again. You have two periods of time when you're making sense. One is while you're dating. Okay. The relationship, and you're practicing the skills and ought to be thinking about it, obviously. So you're constructing an understanding of the relationship and you're constructing the skills to have the relationship. Then the relation falls apart and you have a second period, not in relationship, when you're constructing your understanding of what happened. That process, he's beginning to understand, is as important as developing the relationship skills themselves. Wow. Good question. Great question. The question is, if you just fall in love with somebody when you're 14 and or the first person that you have a dating relationship with and never break up and stay together, as some of your parents did, I suspect. The question is, what happens? Obviously, you're learning a great deal about relationship skills, and they're working, ideally, especially if you're looking back on 40 or 50 years of marriage and you're happy. Are you missing anything by not having that second period to make sense out of what happened? Great question. I don't have a clue. And I will ask Andy if he has any subjects of that sort. I think there are very few people who actually go through that. But he may have a couple. Then we'll find out what they're doing. Most of us don't stay in one relationship through adolescence. Most of us spend a fair amount of time in the emotionally traumatic process of breaking up and making sense of that. So there's a set of ecological transitions for us that are repeated sometimes over and over again. And as that's happening, as I said, what is important is how you are making sense of those. If you're doing that well, then as you enter a new relationship, then you're taking a different understanding of the world into that new relationship. A different understanding of your former relationship and a different understanding of yourself, and taking yourself into a relationship in a way that may be more healthy. That's what Murano in her article is saying we need to do. And what Collins has in his data is evidence that the more relationships you have, and this is contrary to his expectations, before he had the data, he would say, the more relationship experience you have, the more likely you are to have good relationships. It turns out that that's not true. It turns out that in his study, the more relationships people have, that is, the more of the time they're involved in relationships, and the less time they are not in a relationship, so that second period is extremely short for some people. Okay, so they're in a relationship, they break up, 2 days later they're in a new relationship. Okay. As that happens, and that is the pattern for many people, you know the people who can't be alone, they go from relationship to relationship to relationship. If you chart the quality of those relationships, they get worse and worse and worse. As the quality gets worse and worse and worse, the probability of being abused and unhappy in the relationships increases. And those two are obviously related. The quality is going down, abuse and unhappiness are going up. What he appears to have discovered is that there are a reasonable number of people, both male and female, who are not comfortable being alone. They think they have to be in a relationship, and they are desperate to be in relationship for whatever reasons. It would be an interesting developmental trajectory to look at. And as this trajectory continues, they're developing fewer and fewer skills and more likelihood of being in a bad relationship. What they're missing is the opportunity to figure out how to be a person on his or her own. That period of time for reflection, developing a mesosystem that is your own, developing a pattern to your life that includes settings and friends without the involvement in a romantic relationship, that period seems to be important for development. And when people have had that kind of period of non-involvement, then they go into the next relationship with better skills, a more valid view of relationships, and typically more understanding of how relationships have gone bad for them in the past, so they can avoid some of those mistakes in the future. Same pattern in adolescence as in adulthood, when people go from one relationship to another in adulthood, or when they divorce while they're having an affair and move immediately into another relationship, and those second relationships that people leave marriages for are not likely to be even as good as the marriage. And if they result in marriage, the statistical probability is that they will be even shorter than the marriage that they just got out of. So remarriages are more likely to end in divorce. particularly if they are remarriages without a period of time between the relationships. Does that make sense? So when your friends advise you to cool it after you break up, they're right. They also should cool you to talk about it, think about it, write about it, read about relationships, make sure you're really out of the one you've gotten out of before you get into the next one. And that applies to you, and it also applies, as Milano is suggesting, for married people too. Let me give you one of my takes on what happens when people get involved in dating before they're out of a marriage. Yes. Yeah, exactly. What happens if you're in a relationship? That's relationship, okay. Right. Right. How can you still be attached if you've broken up? The biggest problem in divorce is that people forget to get divorced. They get divorced legally, but they forget to get divorced emotionally. And some of you have parents who've been divorced for several years, but they're still married because they make each other mad every day. Right? Exercise 4 was interesting. A lot of you wrote very nice essays about moving to UVM and coming to college and those sorts of ecological transitions. 3 of you wrote about the strokes your fathers had. That was interesting to me that out of a group this size, 3 of you have fathers who've had strokes in middle age. And about 12 of you wrote about your parents' divorce. The earliest being about 18 months and the oldest being one that's going on right now. We should have a separate section for you. I do teach a course on parenting through separation and divorce. Maybe we should recruit your parents, because some of you clearly have parents who haven't figured out how to do this yet. Yeah. So you're still married when you can push each other's buttons, and that may take a long period of time to figure out how to be civil, unconnected co-parents without pushing each other's buttons. As long as people are still making each other mad, as long as you give the other person that power, you're not divorced, even though legally you may be divorced. So what happens when people get into new relationships? Depends on the nature of that new relationship and what they're looking for. The worst case example is when people are still married and start dating. Yeah. Dating somebody else while you're married is not nice. Yeah. Affairs are not nice. And affairs are interesting ecologically. So here's my brief take on them, and we'll see if that leads back to the question. Let's start with the worst case scenario. You're dating. So you have a spouse or partner, and then there's you, and then you have a new partner. And people start doing that. For some, it's just habits. You know, you want as many partners as you can, or why restrict yourself to one? And there are probably lots of developmental reasons for that, but we won't go into them. What happens is that typically there's some negative affect in the primary relationship. And people are looking for something better. And so they find something, somebody who's better. And the problem with that, dyadically, is that you're looking at this dyadic relationship between yourself and the new partner in the context of being partnered with somebody else.
That's not a clean relationship. It's a relationship that exists in the context of the primary, the preceding relationship. And there's a hypothesis in Bronfenbrenner about the potential for a relationship to be developmentally facilitating, being affected by each person's involvement in other dyadic relationships. Remember that one? That's in part about affairs. It's in part about parents supporting each other, but it's also about affairs. The new partner is likely to have several unrealistic characteristics because that second relationship exists within the context of the first. One of those characteristics is that the new partner is unlikely to support the dyadic relationship that preceded. So if you find somebody to have an affair with who thinks you should stay married and wants you to have a really fine relationship with your spouse and just wants to be a little something on the side, that might be fine. And often, I think, often people talk themselves into believing that's what they've got. But it's unlikely that your new partner really wants you to have a great relationship with the current spouse. So there's likely to be some at least subtle work to keep you out of the spousal relationship. In the second place, most of us don't have enough time for two or three or four primary dyadic relationships with partners with sex involved. You just don't have enough time, unless you're independently wealthy and fly your own jet or something like that. Most of us just don't have enough time to divide our energies between two partners. So somebody or both are always going to get the short end of the relationship. So the presence of that second relationship is going to interfere with putting in appropriate time and energy, reciprocal activities, joint activities, positive affect with the original spouse. Third problem in the affair relationship is that the new partner is expected to be different from and better than the original spouse. That means that the new partner is always being evaluated in terms of his or her comparison to the original spouse. You don't want, I hope. Now let me depersonalize that. It is not as healthy in a relationship to be evaluated according to how different you are from somebody else as it is to be evaluated on the basis of who you are and what you put into the relationship. In other words, a dyadic relationship that is clean, that is not in the context of other dyadic relationships, allows the partners to evaluate each other as people, as independent people, and to evaluate their relationship by itself as an independent entity. It is the relationship, and it is the only one that they're involved in. When there's an affair going on, that relationship is always inevitably compared to the other relationship. And the partner in the second relationship is always inevitably compared to the spouse. Usually favorably. That's why people have affairs. Within that context, then a couple of things are likely to happen. One is the spouse is likely to find out. It's very difficult to maintain, and though people do it, I have great admiration for their ability to manage their ecosystems. I don't understand it. But people can have long-term affairs that their spouses do not, in fact, know about, at least for a while. At least for a while, you know, 15, 20 years maybe. There are people who manage to have two families. What's the name of the book? There was a book by a son. It came out last year, the year before. There was an insurance executive in, I think, in Florida, who had two complete families. He was married to both women. They had kids. I've forgotten the name of, I've forgotten his name. But he had lots of money, and he was able to have two complete families and maintain two microsystems. Boggles my mind, but you can do it. It's interesting. It would be an interesting project to read the book written by one of his sons, trying to understand who the heck his father was and how he did this and the impact that it had. And he kept it secret from both of them for many years until he died. And then he left both families to deal with it. And, you know, so, but he's extremely rare. Good enough to write books about. And if you want to read, remind me to find the name of the book. So the spouse is going to find out. That's going to increase the negative affect. A reasonable spouse whose partner is having an affair will say, end it now, go to marriage counseling with me, or pack your bags and get out.
I'm just thinking about how if the married couple is less, it's less, like there's probably different degrees that people
can go. Yep. What happens sometimes, the question, the observation is that sometimes couples really aren't very attached. They're not really in an intense relationship. It has cooled, or they never really were in one. And often a spouse will know that the other person is having an affair, or suspect that, and say, that's just fine. You know, keeps her out of mischief, doesn't bother me. That's more likely to happen if there's very little connection between them, or if the other person is also having an affair. But what's more likely to happen when the spouse finds out or begins to suspect is the affect is going to get really negative, and then there'll be some questioning, confrontation. And with any kind of evidence that there really is an affair going on, a major sense of betrayal and loss of trust in the partner, which often leads immediately and directly to several possible indicators of very negative affect. One is murder. And in many societies, if you actually catch your partner, your spouse, with the other person, you have the right to kill them both. And in this society, there's a fair sense that it's probably justifiable homicide, or at least it's not going to get you a long sentence. You may go to jail. But if you catch your spouse in bed with somebody else, people will usually be able to plead temporary insanity, and a jury will say, yep, you got it. So the murder is one. Immediate trip to a lawyer, immediate filing for divorce, followed sometimes, depending on the situation that you're in, with a tip-off to the IRS. One of the saddest students I've worked with in the last few years, while she was taking my course on parenting through separation and divorce, there are always students there whose parents have been through it, and often, over the course of the semester, somebody in the course whose parents will separate. Not because the student is taking a course, it's just, I don't know why.
But this particular student came back from a weekend at home wondering whether she could finish the course because her mother had just found out that her father, in fact, had been having a long-term affair. And the reason she found it out was that her father was working overseas for a while. And she had an inquiry from the IRS about his tax return. And rather than bother him, she went into their tax files and found all kinds of interesting things. She had trusted him because he had an MBA in finance to do their taxes. And she just signed the form. There's a good reason not to do that. Why a couple should work it out together and you should know where all the money is. So she discovered that not only had he been cheating on his taxes, their taxes, for a number of years, he had had a long-standing affair, was paying the rent on the other woman's apartment in the same city. And the IRS was hot on his trail. So she called her lawyer. They went through all the stuff. She called the IRS, gave them all the stuff, and they got him when he got off the plane. And I think he got 5 to 8 in federal penitentiary for income tax fraud. He also got a divorce. He also got the disappointment of his children rather dramatically. So anyway, if you're doing something wrong in some way, it's likely that the betrayed spouse is going to let the world know about that as part of the retribution process. Okay. Or, what sometimes happens, and I've watched a couple of people do this, they wait until they're pretty sure that the affair is going on, and then they make a safe situation, loving, supportive situation for the spouse who's having the affair to tell them that they're having the affair. And then once they get that nailed down, they say, "Thanks, sucker, I'm out of here." And then they go. Sometimes the relationship has really cooled and the partner who's not having the affair is just waiting, watching for the other person to give him or her an opportunity to get out. Okay. Next step in the ecological transition is the relationship with the spouse ends, and there you are. The new partner is already in place. There are typically some expectations now about what will happen. Most people who are having affairs with married people, in the context of that, assume that, and this is a fatal assumption for the relationship, you assume that the person really does want to have a relationship with you and therefore will become your new partner and you can move in and you'll get married and that's, life will be happy forever. The problem is that for many people, the new relationship can't survive on its own. Its value was that it was better than the one that no longer exists. So when the ecosystem changes so the comparison is not there, then what may happen is that the person who is having the affair looks at the second partner and decides, "Well, I can still do better than this." Or, "It was very nice to be in a relationship with you when I didn't have to do anything in the relationship. It was just something on the side, and it was very important, and it was very useful, and I like you very much, and you've been really good for me, and you helped me out of my relationship. Thank you very much. Now I'm going to move on." That leaves the second partner typically with a very large and deep sense of betrayal. And that's likely to happen. As a result of that, my advice to people who are having affairs or are new partners after somebody's just broken up is just assume that you will be the person who allows the other person to heal and get on with his or her life. but don't expect to be the permanent partner. It's unlikely. You're going to be the healing person. So do that. It's a nice role. And then expect the other person to move on to somebody else. There's a developmental trajectory that's potential in affairs. And I watched a very dear friend of mine go through this. She married a man who'd been married before, and she knew when she married him that he'd had an affair, which is what ended his first marriage. Not with her. She wouldn't do that. But he'd had an affair that ended his first marriage. They got married. In the back of my mind always is, why isn't that person going to have an affair while married to you? Are you so much better than any other partner? Or has the person grown so much that he can tell you or she can tell you exactly why the relationship occurred and why it would never happen again, an affair would happen again? So, their marriage lasted 5 years and two kids until she found out he was having an affair. And fortunately, she was disappointed, she was angry, but she had also had a very good financial sense, and they had a very clear plan for what would happen to them. So she made out financially just fine. The bottom line for that is, if somebody has cheated on a partner to be with you, and that wasn't their case, but if that has happened, you probably need to think about whether you want to be with somebody who cheats on his or her partner. Because if you're the partner, the probability is increased that that will happen again. During the course of the divorce, that particular friend found that her husband had told her about the marriage and the affair, but he had neglected to tell her about his first marriage and the affair that ended that. So he wasn't completely honest in many ways. So. Okay. What else did you want to know? Or how else was the situation you wanted to ask about different? How do you go through separating yourself from the other person when a relationship breaks up? How do you change your view of the world and yourself and accept that the other person has the right to do what he or she pleases in future relationships? Without bending yourself out of shape because he or she is now dating somebody else and wanting to know who that person is and all about them, and that gets us back to the potential for stalking. But the other potential in that is beating yourself up constantly because the other person has a life that you admire and it's not with you. And the best way to get over that is to find somebody else that you can have a wonderful time with that treats you better than the partner that you're no longer with. So, even if there's constant contact, yeah. Often our ecosystems are not really separable, and if the relationship has been really good, and is between two relatively mature people, they may continue that friend as a friendship or a working relationship for years. Couples get divorced and remain business partners. Couples get divorced and continue to parent their children and have a good time. A couple of you wrote about parents who are actually quite good friends now that they're no longer required to be partners. In fact, one of the things that happens in divorce is that you have the opportunity, and divorce should resolve a problem or two. It also, in the context of marriage, should be the
last resort when you've tried everything else. And when you decide that you can't stay together, then it's the last resort. Everybody ought to feel better, ideally. Okay, we're resolving our problems, and now we're going to do that in a civil way. We're going to carry out our responsibilities to our children, and we're not going to continue to make life miserable for each other. That's the best case scenario, divorce. And some people do that, whether it's a divorce or the end of a relationship. They decide, this isn't going to work, but I really like you as a friend, and I hope we can maintain our friendship. In those cases, people can develop a good relationship. They have joint activity patterns. They just may have a bad sex life, or they may not be really in love with each other, but they can be good friends. Primary dyadic relationships may continue. You can encourage that to happen, and I'll give you the advice that my daughter gave me, having been raised to understand that friendships are really, really, really important, and romantic relationships are less important. She translated that into, in adolescence particularly, she translated that when she was about in eighth grade to a goal in her life as she started dating. And it's absolutely wonderful, so I pass it along. The goal in dating is to make sure that every partner, when the romantic part of the relationship ends, remains a good friend. That's taking an interesting developmental perspective about relationships and their future. So her goal was, if you're going to start dating, you probably ought to know the person enough to be at least friendly and interested, and then you date your partners for a while, and then the goal agreed upon by both is that after you've dated, assuming that you don't get married, and it's fairly easy to suggest that when you're in 9th or 10th grade, the goal is to be friends. What does that mean if that's your goal? It means that you treat each other as friends while you're dating. That might seem obvious, but I would bet a good number of you have had dating romantic relationships where you were not treated as a friend. You were treated as a partner, and for some people that's different. You were treated as a girlfriend or a boyfriend. That's different. And some people don't understand that one of the elements of a good romantic relationship is that you're also good friends. Okay? So you treat each other differently if your goal is to be and remain friends. You recognize that you're trying out the romantic part, exploring that part of a relationship, and that may not go anywhere. It may not be satisfying. It may not be possible for you to create a good dyadic relationship that goes beyond friendship. So you leave each other the option of ending that part of the relationship and maintaining the friendship. That means, if you've agreed to do that at the beginning, that means that you break up differently. You break up as friends. You end the relationship much more cleanly and supportively and gently than many of you have had relationships end when you weren't focused on being friends. Does that make sense? If you start off thinking we might have a lifelong marriage here, but we have to go through some steps to get there, and we would like to be friends whether or not we get married, then you treat each other differently. You define the roles, and you define the nature of the relationship differently. Friends have reciprocity. Friends have and try to maintain positive affect. Friends have equal power. And if that's what you want to have happen, the relationship, the romantic part of it, is likely to be kept in perspective, and you're likely to treat each other differently than often happens because people define the role of friend and the role of partner differently. it's a reason to talk about. What do you mean by friendship? What do you mean by partner? How does that go? But what if one of you is still madly in love with the other person who is no longer in love with you? The best cure for that is a new relationship. Before that, you have to manage yourself. And that means perhaps creating a relationship that doesn't tear you up too much. It may require involving yourself in activities that will take the place of, or at least substitute for, the relationship you hoped would go on forever. It may mean that you do an awful lot of journaling. You're using the period between, the period of being separate, to figure out who you are without this person, and working to understand what that relationship was about. Part of it is deliberate refusal to try to convince the other person that he or she is wrong to leave you, to end the relationship. So there's some self-talk about what is appropriate behavior and trying to influence the other person to be anything more than friends is inappropriate. It's going to keep you hanging in there. It's appropriate to talk to other people, and if it bothers you for very long, what's very long? I would say if you're still torn up over a relationship that wasn't marriage and wasn't cohabiting, I mean, what would you say? How long? At what point do you seek professional help? One day, if it's interfering with your life. A week, if it still hurts as much a week later, that's probably time to go talk to somebody. Counseling is, for students, part of your tuition. You go to the counseling center and you do some grief therapy about the loss of the relationship. You put yourself back in shape and you start to move on. The more intense and long-term the relationship was, the longer it may take you to get over it, but any time it's interfering with your life, you're spending an awful lot of time crying and unable to do things and depressed, probably need some help. If your ways of coping with the grief are unhealthy, if you find yourself drinking or doing drugs, you need to go immediately to the counseling center or to your private therapist or whatever, because that's not an appropriate way to deal with grief. It's destructive. If you find yourself unable to go out and have fun or to do work, if you find yourself falling apart periodically, regularly, you need to get help. You need somebody to walk you through that process. Breaking up in really good relationships, being dumped, is extremely painful. And it does often take a long period of time to come to terms with it. Especially if you are holding on to the notion that the other person might come to her senses and realize what a wonderful person you are. It helps to know that the other person is married. You know, that sort of puts closure to it. So, you know, if you've been a partner of somebody who's having difficulty getting over it, you know, if you get married, you know, sort of have somebody tell them. You don't have to invite them to your wedding, but have somebody tell them. Yeah. Other advice? You've never been dumped. Yeah. Okay. I have. It hurts, you know. And you know what really pissed me off about that one? I held on to it for a long time. The journaling, the therapy, and all that stuff. You gradually get off. What really pissed me off was that one of our mutual friends actually went to her wedding and never thought We didn't see the mutual friend, and I didn't see each other very often. She never thought to check in whether I knew that my former fiance, in that case, had gotten married. About 2 years before I found out. I was annoyed. I was really annoyed. Okay, anyway. I'm over it. Hopefully. And having another good relationship and falling in love with somebody else really does help. I keep looking at you because I'm assuming there's some... I'm waiting for some follow-up question. Okay, so then you break up, and then eventually you find somebody that you actually want to make a commitment to, somebody you want to unite with, somebody you want to marry, and you start cohabiting. We've been through that, and you decide to get married. Why would you want to get married? What legal rights do you have if you cohabit? Some of you who've cohabited. My main source isn't here today. How many of you cohabited? What legal rights do you have? Nothing. Nothing. So much for that. Except in some states where if you cohabit long enough, 7 years, you can claim to be, if you choose to, you can claim to be in a common law marriage, okay, which is marriage under the common law, English common law, which says if two people act like they're married and they live as if they're married and they cohabit and they have sex and they perhaps have kids, then maybe the law should accept that they are married. The law won't automatically do that. And in most states, I believe it's still 7 years. And I don't know how many states still recognize common law marriages. Vermont is not one. You can cohabit your entire life. You have absolutely no rights unless you define them by contract. But as far as the state is concerned, you have no rights at all. But in some states, if you have lived together as man and wife, I don't think they let it happen for same-sex couples yet. Probably never will. If you have lived together for 7 years and one of you chooses to claim that you are in a common law marriage, then a judge will decide if that's appropriate and declare you to be married with all the rights, privileges, honors, and obligations that come along with a legal marriage. So it's a way to get married when the partner doesn't want to do that. Well, if both of you want to do it, why not go get married? I mean, same deal. Common law marriages typically are only activated when one person is pissed at the other person is leaving. So it's like divorce, but before you can get divorced and have some legal rights, you have to declare yourselves married. Or the person has died, and you want the inheritance rights that come along with being a spouse. So otherwise, there's no reason to claim, and unless there's some problem between you, there's no reason to claim common law marriage. And in Vermont, you can't do that anyway, so it doesn't matter. But in some states, I think there are 14 or 15 states that still recognize common law marriage. There was a question. Ménage à trois. This is not a personal question. Okay, good. I have no idea. What happens if you're cohabiting with one or more person in a common law marriage state, you can claim to be married to one of them, but only one of them. And probably then immediately, the mind boggles about the possibility that you're going to be granted a marriage and charged with bigamy at the same, I don't know, adultery at the same time. As long as you're in a common law marriage, you can't be charged with adultery.
I mean, as long as you're cohabiting, I'm not in a common law marriage. You can't. If you're cohabiting and not in a common law marriage, you can't be charged with adultery. If you're married, you can be charged with adultery, which is still illegal in some states. Not in Vermont. But in some states, you can be taken to court, you can be charged by the police, you can be put in jail for the crime of adultery. Those tend to be the same states that will throw you in jail for sodomy if you sleep with somebody of the same sex. So, if you're going to engage in habits like that or lifestyles like that, you probably want to check out what the laws of your particular state are. And you don't want to do it in Oklahoma. So, common law marriage gives you the same rights, but only in those states, the same rights as marriage, but only in those states that recognize common law marriage. In the rest of them, you are on your own. Worst case scenario, you raise a couple of kids, you start a business together, you build a house together. It's in her name, and the kids have her name because you never adopted them, which you need to do, or she didn't name you as the father, and she decides you need to leave. You have nothing. There are ways around that. One is to have a legal contract. One is to have both names on the house. One is to declare yourself the parent when the children are born outside of marriage. So you put both names on the birth certificate. That works. One acquaintance of mine cohabited for a number of years. I loved her story because they were together about 10 years. They bought land. He bought land. She helped pay for it. He built a house. She was the contractor for it and designed it. And while he was at work, she got the house built. But it was all in his name. And after about 10 years, she decided that this was not good enough. And he resisted for 2 or 3 years putting her name on the deed. So she finally convinced him to get married. So they got married. And 3 months later, she found out, as she suspected, that he was having an affair. He acknowledged that he had spent the morning of their wedding day with his other partner. And she said, "Okay, sucker." She had two choices at that point, one of which is always to request an annulment of the marriage because it was contracted under false pretenses. He was having an affair. That's grounds for annulment in some states if the person is not really serious about being a faithful partner. But she didn't want to do that. She wanted to get divorced. She got the house. Mortgage free. He was required to pay the rest of the mortgage. She got the house. So that's what she really wanted. People are interested. Good. You want me to stop? But I'm just getting into the good part. Okay. We'll talk about marriage and marriage vows. On Wednesday.